Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is July 18th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, Whatever Happened to Lot's Wife, presented by Kata Schwen. The number is SCK2005-06.
I think we're ready to get started. Josh, you can start the tape now, or the CD, I guess it is now. My name is Kata Schwen, and when I'm not at Holden Village, I live in Iowa City, Iowa, where I attend the Iowa Writers Workshop and do creative writing there. Come on in, grab a poem and a Bible.
Oh, that's right.
And where I'll be teaching creative writing this fall. Just to sort of give you a general overview of what these sessions are doing or trying to do. In each session, we'll be looking at one or two poems pretty closely, and really trying to get at the heart of sort of what the poem itself is about by doing a really close reading. Great, grab a Bible too. At the beginning, I'll also kind of ask a couple larger questions that we'll try to get back to after we kind of do the close readings of these poems. This is very much a Holden discussion, which means that everybody's viewpoints are not only encouraged, but really necessary if we're going to have a good discussion. So debate and disagreement is encouraged. Someone came up to me after the session this morning that we did and said that he hadn't said something and then told me what it was, and it would have been a great thing, but he was just afraid that it would have gone against the grain. So please speak out and say what's on your mind. Both of these poems that we're going to look at are based on Bible stories. And so the question that I kind of want to ask is, we're going to read each poem, and then after we go through it, we're going to ask, what new information have we learned from the story that wasn't present for us initially? Specifically, I want to look at the characters themselves of the prodigal son and Lot's wife. What do these poems explain about these characters that isn't in the story itself? And then at the very end, I want to ask the question, what do we do with that new information? Is it legitimate for that new information to become a part of how we understand that Bible story? Or do we say that that's separate, that that's part of that poet's imagination, and though it might be an interesting poem, or interesting in that context, that it would be kind of altering, trespassing on sacred ground to use that in terms of our understanding of the story itself? Does that make sense, sort of the question that we'll be asking? Wonderful. Okay, so let's start out by opening to Luke 15, 11 through 32. And is there anyone who feels compelled to want to read the story of the prodigal son today? Thank you. Wonderful. Yes, take your time. All right. To further illustrate the point, he told them this story. A man had two sons. When the younger told his father, "I want my share of your estate now, instead of waiting until you die," his father agreed and divided his wealth between his sons. And a few days later, this younger son packed up all his belongings and took a trip to a distant land, and there wasted all his money on parties and prostitutes. About the time his money was gone, a great famine swept over the land, and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him to feed his pigs. And the boy became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding to the swine looked good to him, and no one gave him any money. And when he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, "At home, even the hired men have food enough and to spare. And here I am, dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired man.' So he returned home to his father, and while he was still a long distance away, his father saw him coming and was filled with loving pity and ran and embraced him and kissed him. His son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and you, and am not worthy of being called your son. But his father said to his slaves, Quick, bring the finest robe in the house and put it on him, and a jeweled ring for his finger and shoes, and kill the calf we have been fattening in the pen. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has returned to life. He was lost and is found. And so the party began. Meanwhile, the older son was in the fields working, and when he returned home, he heard dance music coming from the house, and he asked one of the servants what was going on. Your brother is back, he was told, and your father has killed the calf you were fattening and has prepared a great feast to celebrate his coming home again unharmed. The older brother was angry and wouldn't go in. His father came out and begged him, but he replied, All these years I have worked hard for you and never once refused to do a single thing you told me to. And in all that time, you never gave me even one young goat for a feast with my friends. Yet when this son of yours comes back after spending your money on prostitutes, you celebrate by killing the finest calf we have on the place. Oh, look, dear son, his father said to him, you and I are very close, and everything I have is yours. But it is right to celebrate, for he is your brother, and he was dead, and has come back to life. He was lost, and he is found. Thank you very much.
Okay, so this is a story that I assume all of us have heard at one time or another, and probably many times. What are some adjectives that you might use to describe the prodigal son based on this story? How would you describe him as a person?
Selfish.
Selfish, great.
Well, impatient.
Impatient, great.
Irresponsible.
Irresponsible?
Depends on who you're considering the prodigal son in the story.
Okay, thank you, John. Well, in this case, let's consider it to be the one who goes off and we have a whole nother session there. Let's consider it to be the one who goes off and squanders his fortune. Yeah, I know. Bummer. Yeah.
Impulsive.
Great.
Greedy.
Wonderful.
Adventurous.
Okay, so a little positive twist to that.
Mm-hmm. Contrite?
Yeah.
And certainly, like we've said, there's something sort of quick and impulsive about him. He seems youthful, seems to be making these decisions quickly. Yeah.
Inexperienced.
Great.
Lascivious.
Lascivious. Thank you.
Lascivious.
Humbled.
What?
Humbled.
Okay. Ultimately humbled at the end. Great.
As a firstborn, I would definitely say he fits the role as a secondborn child.
Yes. Okay. Typical secondborn. As a firstborn, I would agree.
Yes.
Would you
agree?
Two of my siblings are sitting over there today. Okay, wonderful. So we're all kind of on board. Those all seem to be, it's kind of our idea of the prodigal son. Okay. Let's take a look at the poem now, and some people came in late. Can everybody see a copy? If not, do you guys have one back there to look at? How about upstairs? Do you guys need one? Is there anyone who wouldn't mind?
Do you need more runoff?
I can team up with somebody.
There we go. Okay. I think we're all of it.
Is there another one? Somebody.
Yeah, I'll come up.
Okay. We're okay.
You're okay? All right, great. Okay, so then this is a poem by Elizabeth Bishop, who's a wonderful poet of the 20th century, who's not alive anymore, but is wonderful. I highly recommend her. That being said, the prodigal. The brown, enormous odor he lived by was too close, with its breathing and thick hair, for him to judge. The floor was rotten. The sty was plastered halfway up with glass-smooth dung. Light-lashed, self-righteous, above moving snouts, the pig's eyes followed him, a cheerful stare, even to the sow that always ate her young, till, sickening, he leaned to scratch her head. But sometimes, mornings after drinking bouts, he hid the pints behind a 2x4. The sunrise glazed the barnyard mud with red, The burning puddles seemed to reassure. And then he thought he almost might endure his exile yet another year or more. But evening's the first star came to warn. The farmer whom he worked for came at dark to shut the cows and horses in the barn beneath their overhanging clouds of hay, with pitchforks, faint forked lightnings catching light, safe and companionable as in the ark. The pigs stuck out their little feet and snored. The lantern, like the sun, going away, laid on the mud a pacing oriole. Carrying a bucket along a slimy board, he felt the bat's uncertain staggering flight, his shuddering insights, beyond his control, touching him. But it took him a long time, finally, to make his mind up to go home. Okay, before we start moving through this, I want to point out that we've got two sonnets here. Each of the stanzas is a sonnet. And the sonnets are the same rhyme scheme up until here. And then they change a little bit. So they're kind of equal, but they're not kind of equal. So we have a balancing between those two halves, but something's a little bit off kilter there. And we'll get back to this final couplet of the second one at the end is also very interesting. We'll come to that when we come to it. But we could spend a lot of time talking about form and those implications, but I want to get more to the content. But I did want to point that out just so as we get into what's going on, you can see if that relates to kind of what's going on formally as well. But just to keep that in your head. Okay. So the way that I want to go through this poem and look at it is we have three times the word but appears. Once in that first sonnet, and then twice in the other one. So I want to look at those as four sections to the poem to move through and see kind of what changes occur around the word but. So we begin, the brown enormous odor he lived by was too close with its breathing and thick hair for him to judge. So my first question is, what is being judged here?
Barn, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Pigsty?
The odor. And what would that mean for it to be too close for him to judge? Why?
Too close to his own smell.
To his own smell, okay. So that he's become such a part of his environment that he's having trouble differentiating from it. Awesome. Anybody else want to make a comment about that first?
That he's used to it or something.
Yes.
He's just inured with it.
Yes. And what's... The odor itself, usually when we have an odor described to us, it's described via other scents that it's a combination of. But how is this odor described? It's unusual.
Enormous.
Enormous. And what else?
It's personified.
Yeah. What words?
The arms and the... Or not the arms. The breathing and the thick hair.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this sense that this... We have an odor that's... sort of moving and has texture to it because it's that strong for him. And also I think the word judge here is really important. It becomes important throughout the course of the poem that it's introduced there in the first sentence of this poem is really important, that we have somebody who, like Peter's saying, that his own odor is too close to the odor of these pigs for him to judge the difference there. But as people see other moments of judgment coming out, be sure to mention them. Okay, so then we get, the floor was rotten, the sty was plastered halfway up with glass smooth dung. What kind of image is that for people?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think glass smooth dung is an odd,
mm-hmm.
and I just wouldn't have expected that. I don't really know why.
What's odd about it for you?
Well, when you think of dung, I mean glass.
Yes.
Glass smooth. But rubbed into the wood or the plaster, whichever it was, would
give it
get a glass flat.
Mm-hmm. So there's something that's literally accurate, but at the same time something that seems kind of odd to our sensitivities in that description, that there's a smooth, a glassy quality to this dung. Then we get this interesting description, light-lashed, self-righteous, above moving snouts, the pig's eyes followed him, a cheerful stare, even to the sow that always ate her young, till, sickening, he leaned to scratch her head. When you, for you guys, as you experience this poem, when you read light-lashed, self-righteous, above-moving snouts, what do you think is going to come after?
He.
That we're gonna get a description of the prodigal son, right? Because, you know, we view him as this sort of self-righteous person who's taken off his fortune, but what do we get instead?
The pig's eyes,
right. So again, there's this sense of, just like with that odor, of who is who in this situation? Who's the one who's self-righteous? Who's the one who's light-lashed and who's not? And what else about that sentence gets to people? What? Say more. We have a sow eating her young. Mm-hmm.
Yet he's willing to scratch her head.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, he's already decided he was too close to judge.
Mm-hmm. Great. So that's a gesture of companionship there, even though it's kind of sickening to him.
But that's a pretty good description of a pig.
Mm-hmm.
Light lashes.
Mm-hmm. But a cheerful stare.
A cheerful stare.
Mm-hmm. Cheerful stare. A friendly pig who needs a scratch.
But what about the sow eating the young?
Well, that happens too.
That happens, right? We had this discussion earlier. We had lots of examples of sows eating young that went on for some time, but I was thoroughly convinced that everyone besides me had seen a sow eating their young.
Is it almost something that he's worrying about himself, like going back
okay.
home?
Great.
He's the run through the litter that gets eaten by the sow, his father.
Great, Peter. That's awesome. So that. Already introduced, we have an animal figure that could be nurturing or could eat you. And this, so again, the question of what's gonna be happening back at home is already in there somewhere subconsciously.
I find it a little confusing because it says, till sickening he leaned to scratch her head.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time as though they've been talking about him. I mean, it's an unusual use of the pronoun in that word, that he's the one, and yet they've been talking about the pig the whole time. Who's sickening here?
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a good question. Anybody? How do people read it?
I almost thought like the sickening was like a comment from the outside, like, isn't this sickening? I mean, but I didn't even so like from the observer standpoint or something.
Okay.
I think that's probably not right.
Well, at the very least, we have already three perspectives on where the sickening is coming from, right? That if you read it as, I think the sort of first reading is that he's sickening, like it's sickening to him, but is that from further outside that somebody else has seen this? Is this more personally coming from him? Where is it? Okay, so we have, so thus far, is this a happy place? A place that we want to be? Is this a utopia kind of place or no? What's it like?
I would say no.
No, no, great. What kind of, that was the right answer. okay, but then we get but, okay? But sometimes, mornings after drinking bouts, he hid pints behind a 2x4, the sunrise glazed the barnyard mud with red. The burning puddles seemed to reassure. And then he thought he almost might endure his exile yet another year or more. So we have a shift, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's this vision? How is it different than the first half?
It's a great time shift.
Yeah?
Well, I mean, pints weren't there, and 2x4s weren't there.
Okay. So we're dealing with a more, perhaps, modern version of this story, bringing
it down home.
Great.
Well, the word that stuck out to me immediately was exile.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have called it, it's self-chosen here.
Yeah, exactly. Great. Yep. And what, this is a happier vision, right, of of the same place that we got.
He's kind of loaded, I think. So, isn't that true? He's kind of loaded. So
yeah.
The barnyard red is not as red. I mean, he's feeling pretty good today.
Mm-hmm. And what time of day are we at?
Morning.
Morning. Morning. So everything's kind of looking a little bit better. We've got the sunset,
sunrise.
The puddles looking pretty. Right?
Sunrise.
Sunrise, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, anybody else want to say anything? That's great. I love the pointing out exile.
Well, it seems like it's more optimistic than the first half because there's
yeah.
some sort of hope here,
sure.
or agency, like, you know, well, maybe I'll make it through this.
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
and the whole thing about exile, I mean, it makes him sound like he's a victim or something,
yeah.
anyway. Like somebody
that's,
exiled him,
that's
like
right.
he's been sent away for a year, but, you know, the story we read in the New Testament, it's self-imposed.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he's talked himself into that. You know, I had to go away with all that money. I now wonder.
Yep.
And then I guess this kind of brings up the judging theme again. Like, we, the readers, are, at least coming from a Christian perspective, have kind of traditionally looked down on the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
And here, it seems like Elizabeth Bishop is telling us, or calling into question that view, our immediate bias against him.
Okay. So maybe that there's like double judgment going on here. There's the judgment that the son is having to make, and there's also something pointing at what's our judgment of the story? How is that being formed? Okay.
On the other end, you could argue that the whole view after the butt is basically the view through a hangover. In other words, typically you wake up with a hangover, eyes bloodshot, and it's projected onto the scene. The mud's red, the puddles are burning. So that, and the word seem, suggests that basically it's an impression that he gets and a feeling that he has, but only through the eyes of somebody who's totally in a hangover.
Right. So the redness might be a filter of on his own vision rather
own
than
vision,
the sun
right.
on the puddles. There's
yeah.
two. There's a judgment call we have to make there about kind of what's going on. Great.
And then you have this whole he almost might endure. It seems so lonely and
yeah.
so to might endure. Is a little bit of hopelessness then too.
Yeah. But also I think like bringing that out is that his goal is to be able to endure,
right?
To be able to stay.
He thinks he's tough enough.
Yeah. Yeah. But there's okay, but then we get another but. But evening's the first star came to warn. What's the star warning about? They know.
That he's not going to be able to endure this. And this, the coming of night sort of reminds him that he needs to go home and that he's not going to be able to endure it in this place anymore.
Okay, so the star warns both physically about the coming of night, but that we'll read on here and see what does the coming of night remind him of.
Would it make it easier if there were a comma after the word evenings? Or would that change the meaning?
What do people think?
But evenings, the first star came to warn. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, they haven't been used anywhere else, so it would be kind of an odd break.
I don't know. I think, though, it's interesting. I mean, sometimes we find ourselves in our own pig pen.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to say that everything looks brighter and better
in the morning.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And night is, I think, you know, a time of quiet, pronounced loneliness, more self-reflection.
Yeah.
So, you know, even in bad times in our lives, you know, daytime, light, things can be better.
Yeah.
And the evening is a time to reflect.
Yeah. And I think that's absolutely true. And then on the other hand, she's also kind of playing, I think, we'll see with like what Mark was saying, that but the vision of morning is also this one
sure.
glazed through hangover. So yes, it is positive. But then if we take a step back, but maybe it's also tainted, and whereas this vision of night that we're going to be getting, which is usually the more scary, introspective time, we get The farmer whom he worked for came at dark to shut the cows and horses in the barn beneath their overhanging clouds of hay, with pitchforks, faint forked lightnings, catching light, safe and companionable as in the ark. The pigs stuck out their little feet and snored. So what sort of vision is that? What's the barn like as composed as compared to the sty? Yeah, John.
Oh, I was going to say something.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
Well, I was going to say the farmer, it's interesting, he's kind of like the patriarchal figure in this. It's shutting him in, as opposed to his father back at home, who was, you know, letting him go, free. And now he's suffering that, but he's also suffering as a result of being shut in now. So.
Okay, great.
The other thing that caught me in the first line of that, right after the but, is each day he must be going through the same ordeal. This is not something that isn't happening over and over again, the way this sounds, and that's got to be tough also.
Yeah, great. So embedded in there is an emphasis on how long we've been doing this for. Great. But back to somebody say more about what this barn is like as compared to the sty.
I feel warm and toasty.
Warm and toasty, great.
You can almost smell the hay.
Yes.
And if you've grown up with barns, that's a comforting smell.
Yeah, it's a nice kind of happy place, and we have a farmer who's caretaking. So if we had a sow who was eating her young in the first stanza, we now have a farmer who's making sure that the pigs are tucked in nicely. So again, we have another version here of caretaking, of parenting.
But do the pigs actually get in? They shut the cows and horses in the barn.
That's a good question. They
stay out in the sty.
Yeah, they stay out in the sty, don't they?
But at the very least, they're kind of cozy and content when you say that the pigs
lie down on the
their little snores. But that's a great point, that the pigs might still be outside. I'm gonna go a little bit faster here so we can make sure to get through both poems. Okay, so then we get the lantern like the sun going away, laid on the mud, a pacing oriole, carrying a bucket along a slimy board. He felt the bat's uncertain, staggering flight, his shuddering insights beyond his control, touching him. So what physically is the prodigal son doing in this last image of him?
He's feeding the
pigs. Well, what is he on?
Slimy board.
He's on a slimy board. So we have an issue here of balance, right? He's trying to carry something along a slimy board, and what's touching him?
The bats.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love this image very much, of this sense of trying to maintain one's balance. You're feeling sort of the gentle touches of bats around and sort of what that would feel like.
And they're able to maneuver because it's night.
Yes, unlike him, who's having difficulty. What about, somebody says something about, we get shuddering insights that are beyond his control. What are those shuddering insights, and why are they beyond his control? What is?
Here I am on this slimy board out in the night. What am I doing here?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so shuddering insights.
Or sensing the animal's contentness against his very uncontentedness.
Great. So all of these things, yeah. I could be at home.
Yeah.
Well, that's the next but.
Yeah. Right.
Next but.
And why are they beyond his control? Usually when we talk about insights, they're sort of good things, like, oh, I had an insight yesterday, and now I know I should do this. But there's something here that's not control, that's maybe not desire.
Yeah. Frightening?
What?
He was frightened?
Yeah, that maybe there are insights that he doesn't want that are more frightening than positive for him.
Well, I wonder if he thinks it's beyond his control because he chose to leave, and he thinks, now I've made my bed, I've got to lie in it.
Okay.
There's nothing I can do about it.
Great.
Until he decides.
And again, also here we've got, in the first stanza, we got images of puddles and mud and things like that. Here in the barn, we're up higher with the hay-like clouds and the faint forked lightning. So there's kind of a balancing going on there as well.
Yeah, that was me, but.
So then we get the final but. But it took him a long time. Yes.
I'd like to say a little something about the parallel between he felt the bats and his insights.
Go for it. Yes.
And in terms of, I think, both of those. As I read it, I don't think he's actually feeling the bats.
Okay.
That experience is when you're out there and those bats are dodging around. You know, you start ducking and weaving like that too, although they'll never touch you, but you project that.
Okay.
And I think these insights he has that are beyond his control about, I can't go home again, you know, I've made my bed, and so those two are those projections, just like those bats. And
mm-hmm.
so there's a sense of, now how does one respond to the way in which he understands his reality? And I think that sets it up for the but.
Great, that's wonderful, thank you. So that sense of projection and the sense of balancing, of trying to keep himself steady, again this theme of judgment that we have here, of which way are we going to read things as readers? How are we going to judge this poem? How are we going to judge his character? How are we going to judge specific details within the poem? Is it a hangover that's glazing his vision, or is it the sun itself? So there's judgment calls that are needing to be made both by the prodigal and by us as readers, right? Is everybody kind of on board with that idea, more or less?
I like a comment on touching him.
Yeah.
There's a gentleness to that
okay.
that you don't have throughout.
Okay. So whether that's real or the projected imagined touching, it's sort of it's great either way. But it took him a long time finally to make his mind up to go home. And I, one of the most powerful moments for me in this poem is this, that the desire to rhyme time with home and not quite having that fit. Because the sonnet itself, she's prepared us so that it should go GG at the end. We should have a final couplet that kind of finishes things off, and we feel complete and we feel done. And time and home both have that M sound in it. They're these four-letter words. They're very close, but they don't quite match. Does that make sense to everybody? I think when you read it, that we at some level we feel that. We feel that not quite fitting, not quite being done or complete. Okay, so the question then is, what's different about the prodigal son that we experience in this poem than the one that we experience in the Bible story?
Well, it's not resolved. I mean, even with the rhyming, as you suggest, it's disconcerting that those two things don't rhyme, and he's
okay.
made a decision to go home, but that's not. A lot of the story in the Bible is about what happened after he went home.
Great.
And there's a real resolution there because he's accepted. We don't really know, based on the poem, what's going to happen when he goes home. Or actually, we don't even know if he's going to go home.
Right.
To tell the truth, he just says he's going to. Thinks he might.
Great. What else?
How many more years was this a long time?
Yeah, so the sense of time. Time. The Bible story doesn't really tell us exactly how long that in between time was, and this poem seems to want to point to a more specific length in there. What else? We said that earlier when we were talking about the Bible story, there is the sense that the son was making snap judgments and was impetuous and was. Is there a different story here in this poem?
Well, he seems a little bit more thoughtful.
More thoughtful, absolutely. What else?
I think he seems more lonely.
Lonely? So his sense of loneliness and isolation is definitely brought forth.
He's willing to persevere more through what he's been put into,
okay.
instead of just taking the easiest.
I think it's, to use a Jewish phrase, I think it's a midrash on the phrase, when he came to himself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to ask, the next question is, if you had to insert this poem into the Bible story, where would it go?
I think it would go in there.
Yes. And especially because in my version, that also begins with a but. But when he came to himself, he said. And so what I'm just wondering what the Bible story would be like if we got, he would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. The brown, enormous odor he lived by was too close, with its breathing and thick hair, for him to judge, blah, 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 all the way through. But it took him a long time, finally, to make his mind up to go home. But when he came to himself, he said that that would be an interesting place to insert this. Okay, so we have the sense of things being unresolved. We have a different sense of time, how long he was out there for, that he's more thoughtful, his loneliness, his isolation, his ability to sort of persevere through this. Anything else?
The biblical story is, I'll turn it around and say that the poem is much more sensual than the biblical story, which is cerebral. The process is primarily one of thinking in the text and much more sensual in the poem.
And the sensual, what's like a specific sensual moment that you enjoy in the poem? That what do those sensual things bring out for you about it? That you wouldn't maybe have gotten from just reading the story alone, from going through with your brain?
Well, I think the first one makes the discomfort very real, sensuous.
Okay.
And likewise, the second part is an equal contrast in revealing the comfort of the animals and the care of the farmer. And that's to pass over the specific kind of words that were mentioned along the way that are, you know, very sensuous, whether it's touch or smell or sight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The language is just more beautiful in the poem. Mm-hmm. If you read through the passage, it doesn't have that same language.
Yeah. That's great.
Doesn't he relive the exile over and over again? I mean, isn't that the point of the earlier question about where are the pigs?
Mm-hmm.
When the farmer shuts the horses in the barn, he shuts the son out of the barn night after night after night. I mean, in other words, the pigs seem clearly to me to be in the sty, which is outside.
Me too.
So when he shuts the barn door, the prodigal son feels this, I mean, the word exile seems to kind of happen to him daily.
Mm-hmm.
As he's shut out of the care of Noah, who protectively protects all of the animals from the flood, he's left outside.
Mm-hmm. So that that in that reliving, that the notion that the son suffered something before returning, so there's like suffering there too. I think we don't get it. Okay. Well, we can add more to these when we come back, but I want to make sure we try to get through the second poem. Actually, while I'm passing this out, will someone read? We're going to do Genesis 19, 12 through 29.
No.
Is there someone who would read that while I pass these out? Who will be the reader?
I've got it. So
great.
12 through 29.
12 through 29.
Genesis 19.
Genesis 19.
The two men said to Lot, "Do you have anyone else here, sons-in-law, sons or daughters, or anyone else in the city who belongs to you? Get them out of here, because we are going to destroy this place. The outcry to the Lord against his people is so great that he has sent us to destroy them." So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law.
were pledged to marry his daughters. He said, "Hurry and get out of this place, because the Lord is about to destroy the city." But his sons-in-law thought he was joking. With the coming of dawn, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Hurry, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away when the city is punished." When he hesitated, the men grasped his hand and the hands of his wife and of his two daughters and led them safely out of the city, for the Lord was merciful to them. As soon as they had brought them out, one of them said, "Flee for your lives. Don't look back and don't stop anywhere in the plain. Flee to the mountains or you will be swept away." But Lot said to them, "No, my lords, please. Your servant has found favor in your eyes, and you have shown great kindness to me in sparing my life. But I can't flee to the mountains. This disaster will overtake me, and I'll die. Look, here is a town near enough to run to, and it is small. Let me flee to it. It is very small, isn't it? Then my life will be spared." He said to him, "Very well, I will grant this request too. I will not overthrow the town you speak of. But flee there quickly, because I cannot do anything until you reach it." That is why the town was called Zoar. By the time Lot reached Zoar, the sun had risen over the land. Then the Lord rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. Thus he overthrew those cities and the entire plain, including all those living in the cities, and also the vegetation in the land. But Lot's wife looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and returned to the place where he had stood before the Lord. He looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah, toward all the land of the plain, and he saw dense smoke rising from the land, like smoke from a furnace. So God destroyed the cities of the plain. He remembered Abraham, and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived.
Thank you very much, Dan. Okay, so based on this, what do we know about Lot's wife?
She looked back.
She looked back. Do we know anything else?
Nope.
Nope. We hear about her a lot, but all we have is, but Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt, right? That's pretty much all we know. How about Lot? What do we know about Lot based on this story?
Lot questioned, hesitated, had doubts.
Okay, great. Now the angels say, go to the hills, and Lot's like, can I do the city instead? The hills aren't seeming too good to me, right? I mean, here's a guy who's getting directions from angels and is trying to negotiate a little bit about where he wants to escape to, okay? Anything else?
We never know her name.
We never know her name. Anything else people want to say about her, what we know about her or him before we read the... Okay, well, we can say something else.
Well, I always felt she kind of got the short end of the stick.
Okay.
Because I guess I'm a curious person.
Okay.
I quite possibly would have looked back.
I think this poem will speak to you. Lot's Wife by Wisława Zimborska, who, by the way, is an excellent Polish poet she's, I think, in her 90s now, won the Nobel Prize a few years back, and her collected poems is her Nobel acceptance speech, which is phenomenal. I highly recommend it. Okay, that's my little plug. Lot's Wife. They say I looked back out of curiosity, but I could have had other reasons. I looked back mourning my silver bowl, carelessly while tying my sandal strap, so I wouldn't have to keep staring at the righteous nape of my husband Lot's neck, from the sudden conviction that if I dropped dead, he wouldn't so much as hesitate, from the disobedience of the meek, checking for pursuers, struck by the silence, hoping God had changed his mind. Our two daughters were already vanishing over the hilltop. I felt age within me, distance, the futility of wandering, torpor. I looked back, setting my bundle down. I looked back, not knowing where to set my foot. Serpents appeared on my path, spiders, field mice, baby vultures. They were neither good nor evil now. Every living thing was simply creeping or hopping along in the mass panic. I looked back in desolation, in shame because we had stolen away, wanting to cry out, to go home. Or only when a sudden gust of wind unbound my hair and lifted up my robe. It seemed to me that they were watching from the walls of Sodom and bursting into thunderous laughter again and again. I looked back in anger to savor their terrible fate. I looked back for all the reasons given above. I looked back involuntarily. It was only a rock that turned underfoot, growling at me. It was a sudden crack that stopped me in my tracks. A hamster on its hind paws tottered on the edge. It was then we both glanced back. No, no, I ran on. I crept, I flew upward until darkness fell from the heavens, and with it scorching gravel and dead birds. I couldn't breathe and spun around and around. Anyone who saw me must have thought I was dancing. It's not inconceivable that my eyes were open. It's possible I fell facing the city.
Okay, so obviously all of these reasons for turning back are very different, and some of them are a little bit contradictory. But what are some of the characteristics about Lot's wife that this poem gives us that we didn't have before?
She became a person.
She became a person. Okay. What else?
Some are practical, normal reasons to turn back, and others are absolutely absurd.
Okay. So there's a practical, like give an example of a practical one.
Well, just check out and see what's happening.
Checking out to see what's happening, okay? And then what's an absurd one?
Huh?
And what's one that's more absurd?
Oh, the whole bottom thing, the glasses back on.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's all.
All these ones, the hamster is silly, a crack stopped my tracks, a rock turned underfoot.
Okay.
Stumbling in the wrong place for a long time.
Yeah. So maybe not purposeful
not
at all.
Not purposeful, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, what else? What about when it says things like that I looked back in desolation or shame? What kind of person is that would say that? What do we know about her?
Well, a kind of sensitivity, anyway.
Sensitivity. So she's sensitive.
I think she's also very attuned with many, many things going on around her.
Yeah.
Like
observing.
All kinds of things.
And also realizing that she was part of this sinful community.
Yeah.
Whether she participated in it or not.
Okay. So I'm going to put sense of community.
We don't really know how much she participated in the Genesis story, but this was a pretty awful deal.
Yeah.
That they did.
And yeah.
Is she ashamed of, my gosh, what we did?
Yeah. So, her sense of relation to the greater story is kind of expanded, would you say, or how would you?
Well, I just thought of that with it, looking back at shame.
Uh-huh. So, how they felt towards how the entire family felt towards the greater community is present for sure.
And why is it the wife that perishes, I guess, is the other part. Is there a closer connection to that community with the wife than with the...
Okay. So it brings up that question.
I interrupted you.
That's right. Mm-hmm. She apparently didn't feel very... that she was... felt that she was worthy much in her husband's eyes. At least he wouldn't even look back.
So her,
by drop dead, even so much as hesitate.
So less than perfect relationship with Lot, right?
I would think so.
You think she kind of criticizes him for just being this blind, obedient guy?
I
can't do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She said.
Yeah. Mm.
You're asking me to give up my home.
Right, so she's challenging authority in a way that he's not.
Although he debates with the angels.
Yeah, but he whines about it.
He's a little wimpier than
she is.
Okay.
And she's tired of wandering.
Yeah, tired.
daughter's moving on. And
yes. And anger is there too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she says it.
And though some of these are contradictory, I think that as a whole, what they get back to is what? Tell me your name, sir. The green shirt. What's your name?
Harry.
Harry?
No, I'm sorry.
I think it gets back to what Harry said right at the beginning, which is that the main thing that it does is humanize her. So no longer is she just the figure who turned back, but we have a sense that she might be an actually complex individual with many reasons for having done that.
Well, another thing, but I mean, in the second line she says, but I could have had other reasons. I mean, she's sort of like saying to us, well, you know, who knows?
Right.
Maybe I don't even know.
Maybe
that's
I,
how
yeah.
complicated I am, you know? And these are a gazillion reasons I could have done this, and that's how human beings are. We never really know why we do anything, but here are some really interesting possibilities. So even by saying that, I think it humanizes her more.
Great. And what about this ending, right? We also get at the end here her experience, essentially, right, of being turned into a pillar of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And how is that different than what we witness in the Bible?
Doesn't mention her.
Well, she's, to me, a pillar of salt is stationary and just there.
Yeah.
And she's dancing.
She's dancing,
this
yeah.
is movement.
Movement. Hmm?
Kind of get a picture of kind of a whirlwind.
Yeah.
Especially in a sense of fleeing.
Yep. Great. That movement again. We also get the ending, the last two lines, which are I think are really interesting because a lot of what we get beforehand is from a, spoken from a place of certainty, and then we get these two lines of uncertainty at the end. It's not inconceivable that my eyes were open. It's possible I fell facing the city. So there's that sense of uncertainty of her not even quite knowing what happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't quite know. And somebody else.
Well, it's not even clear that she didn't look back.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, in other words, the point of saying that it's not inconceivable, it's interesting, double negative.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's not inconceivable my eyes were open. I mean, maybe that they were open in the midst of this bizarre dance, but probably they weren't.
And if they weren't, then
she
hasn't
look.
Actually looked.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So that it
that,
could have been her body that turned and her that her eyes weren't open.
Right.
And also I think somebody mentioned in the other class this possibility that what we're given here is a vision of what happened, that there's a separation going on here between body and spirit, and that what we're getting is
mm-hmm.
what happened to her on a more spiritual level, that there was a upward passing, and that's just another reading. Yeah.
There's an indication earlier that her looking back is almost an animal instinct because she and the hamster were doing that.
Yeah.
You know, it was a hamster on its hind paws, and then the next time, it was then we both glanced back.
Yep.
So I mean, it's all the it's again almost as if it were instinctual.
Yeah, and moving along with all those other animals, the spiders and the baby vultures, that they're all kind of on this parade out of there.
Except that all those other animals fit, and the
hamster
is like
bizarre. I know. I've wondered about that translation quite often. If it's supposed to be a funny moment,
or
if it's a bad translation,
or is it some rodent that we're just not?
Yeah.
I mean, some little rodent thing.
I don't know the answer.
Which still would have the same. Sort of the same meaning, but the fact that it's a hamster,
right.
all we can think of is our little hamsters.
Yeah, right. And I'm going to, we could say some more. We have about 5 minutes left, and I do want to bring us into a brief discussion at least about what do we do with this information, because certainly, to a certain extent in the prodigal son story, and definitely in this story, in Lot's wife, if we take as truth sort of what's in this poem, we have a different story on our hands, because I'd argue that changing one character, if we make her human, it changes also the way that the other characters are behaving, right? It changes our interpretation of Lot if we buy this interpretation here. It changes, I think, could even change our interpretation of God's role in the story. In the same way, I think a prodigal son story does that. So the question is, we've read these poems, what do we do with that material? And I don't know the answer at all, so that's why I'm bringing this up, because I'm not sure.
Well, it's odd you use the word information. To me, it's not information. I don't know, when I think of information, I guess it is information, but I think of this as interpretation. I guess
okay.
That's the same. And it, yeah, in both cases, it humanizes the characters, and for me, it enhances the story. But especially the second one, I mean, like the, with Lot, his wife.
Enhances
the story. It just gives the story a full body feeling. It gives me more empathy for the characters in the story. It enables me to remember the story better, relate to it, warm up to it. It's all sort of psychological. I don't know what to say about that in terms of like theology or anything, but in terms of stories, these poems make these better stories. They're pretty good stories to begin with, especially about the sun, but I think the poems make them better stories.
Okay. Yeah, Paul.
I think besides, and I agree with all that, besides stories, and maybe that's why a lot of the Bible is left with such scant detail, mm-hmm. is that truth is pretty hard to get a hold of, and to make absolute statements about this is what happened, or this is what is, whether philosophically or theologically, we can ever do that. This is the absolute truth without any ambiguity and uncertainty. That can't be. We're always going to be uncertain. We're always going to live in mystery. And a lot of life is ambiguous.
So we take it as...
how slippery the truth is.
Okay.
Like Wayne said.
So it's one... It's an added interpretation that we also don't take as being the absolute truth, but might help us in our compilation of a greater one. Okay?
I think it also does something for me. It makes me think of all the other Bible stories that I know, and how sterile are they, and what's missing, and now what? When I go and read those, should I be thinking?
Yep. And we're actually going to do more with just that. In tomorrow's session, we're going to do a little bit of writing on our own, and that question is going to come up again. So we can kind of deal with that in a more personal way, but I think that's a great question.
Yeah, I don't think that necessarily means the stories that we're reading are untrue, but what we need to read more deeper, I guess is the word, or thinking more deeply about what's there. And
they're untrue versus the only truth is two different things, too. Mm-hmm. This is true, but it ain't the only.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it challenges us to return to the text to gather these different versions of truth. Yeah.
The other thing is, too, for so long, these were oral traditions. Things got lost somewhere, or could have potentially gotten lost, and what was recorded could be very different then.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a different telling of the story.
Yeah, who was recording it? And
does anybody want to play devil's advocate in terms of how this could become a problem? That if we just kind of all the time or are reading poems, and there's a lot of certainly fiction that's out there now about redoing Bible stories, rewriting. Is there any, are there potential problems?
It's a total slippery slope, but I don't know what we do about it. I mean, like, you picked out great poems that are really evocative, but you probably could have found some really bad poems, or some interpretations that we would have hated.
Okay.
And we would have said things like, well, we don't think this, I would have said, this doesn't enhance my appreciation story at all. So it's like we sort of bring some kind of implicit standards to this in terms of, you know, the extent to which we find it meaningful or not. But I don't know how those could be absolute or anything.
So you're saying that maybe we need to have a way to critically examine the interpretation?
No, I'm just saying it's gonna be a problem. There are once we let this in, which I think we have to do,
right.
I mean, then it's like, wow. It's not that anything goes. We all sort of decide, you know, like what makes sense to us and what doesn't, and it's just sort of disquieting. But I think that's just sort of the nature of these kinds of stories. I mean, because these poems really do make wonderful meaning out of these stories, for me at least.
Go ahead.
Back us up contextually, I guess, to an earlier element in the previous chapter. Abraham, standing before the Lord, says, "Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked?" And thereafter follows the story with which we're dealing. It seems to me that there's a good bit of that element in Lot's wife's questioning as well, and even more so in the poem. Mm-hmm. Question of, do the righteous get swept away with the wicked?
Yeah, great, wonderful. So it brings out that.
But it also brings up a whole concept, too, of at that particular point, you know, who were the chosen people and what was happening, you know, with that.
Great. So it starts kind of rippling out here.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we change the nature of a single character within
mm-hmm.
the story, a lot of things become questionable. And one gentleman who didn't speak up in the earlier session, but I want to share his insight because I think it's interesting, said, well, I kind of like this thing about Lot's wife. It's nice and everything. But, you know, I've really read that as a pretty straight-up story about disobedience, that it was like God told you to do one thing, and they did something else, and this was what happened. And by not having her character all fleshed out, it made it easier for him to understand that that was what the story was trying to convey. And so that once all this was added, that part of the story didn't come through as well. So that would be kind of more like devil's advocate position of what we maybe have the possibility, there's possibilities for losing things as we add more as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're totally over time now, but thank you everyone for your comments, and it helps me to understand.